Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Of what he's proposing. Now, I'm looking forward to the press following up and making sure that you know I'm not exaggerating. I believe their approach is wrong. And I'm not alone. I have not seen a single independent analysis that says my opponent's economic plan would actually reduce the deficit. Not one. Even analysts who may agree with parts of his economic theory, don't believe that his plan would create more jobs in the short term.
Oh, yes, I'm the great pretender. Pretending that I'm doing well.
My 14th of June 2012, we're slogging through the nightmare of an incompetent Marxist regime without end. Welcome to the Savage Nation. As we speak, the pretender-in-chief, I think he's at a fundraiser right now in New York, this evening in New York City. I do hope that the president is listening to the Savage Nation on the way to the fundraiser with more failed movie stars. There's a great article today's, shockingly, I don't know how ABC permitted Matt Negrin to write this column. As you well know, ABC is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Democrat Party. But here's what he wrote. He said, fixing the economy will be put off for a few hours this evening. President Obama will be busy shaking down some celebrity guests, attending a fundraising dinner hosted by Sarah Yenta Parker and Yenta Winitour at Parker's New York City home. Tickets cost $40,000, about as much as the average person makes in a year. Let me repeat that. The man of the people, the man who was down with the people, the man who was for the people, the man who was against the 1%, you can go to a fundraiser for $40,000, about as much as the average person makes in a year. And what do you get? Well, here's what you get. For $10,000, somebody named Matthew Broderick will sit next to you. Never heard of him. For $5,000, you'll share a table with Will Smith. I don't know who he is. The standard dinner will be overseen by Michelle Obama and will consist not of her normal greasy ribs and fries, which she apparently loves to eat, but for the show dinner, the Stalinist show dinner, there will only be served a dinner approved by Napoleon Bloomberg, locally grown herbs, low-fat beet-garnished eggplant, and a corn and soybean protein shake. No 32-ounce Slurpees. For $2,000, Obama will give you a personal shout-out at the beginning of a speech. For $4,000, he'll serenade you with 3 seconds of Al Green. For bundling $500,000 for his re-election campaign, he'll make you the ambassador to England. And it goes on. That's the name of the game. That's the name of the game. That's the world we live in. That's the election that we're all waiting for it to be over. None of us can believe it. Now, talk radio is interesting. Talk radio is interesting. It's a serial. In essence, each show follows the show before it. They're not separate. They can be separate, but they're not. They're really one continuum. And theoretically, this is like a long-running serial, the type I used to love when I was a young boy, the Lone Ranger, the Green Hornet, things of that nature, radio serials. I am the only one in talk radio who actually grew up listening to the radio. Think about that. I'm the only major talk show host who actually grew up listening to radio as my primary medium. Let me correct what I said or modify what I said. Of course, everyone in talk radio listened to talk radio at some point. But it wasn't the only medium around. When I was a kid, there was no television, if you can believe it. I'm not that old, but the fact is that I used to listen to radio with my dad. We listened to the Green Hornet. I can still smell the secondhand smoke from his Philip Morris cigarettes as we lie on the couch. And He told me that radio is a great, great medium because you had to use your imagination, and he liked it better than the movies. So the young Michael would be lying there inhaling secondhand smoke and getting turned on by the fumes of Philip Morris and listening to radio. And here I am, 1,000 years later, not believing that radio is not seen for what it really is, which is the most powerful form of communication I know of. Email is pretty good, but it's not really personal. Talk radio is much more personalized, I think. So having said all of that, this show is a serial, as I said. And one show really, in a way, is connected to the ones before it. So yesterday, what did we talk about? We talked about my forthcoming public appearances, the first time I will have been seen in a public venue for 8 years, beginning September. I don't have the date yet. I had it this morning somewhere. I don't have it anymore. I lost it already. I'm not very good with emails. But nevertheless, it's somewhere in Marin County Civic Center for September. Write it down. Saturday, September 22nd at the Marin County Civic Center. And the minute we get it, we're going to tell you how you can call them up and get a ticket. You can't now. Then Florida, South Florida. Then I'm trying to do a couple other cities. But the point is, if you want to talk about that or the day before it, remember what we talked about? The molestation of young boys, the most hidden secret in America is young boys, because the Sandusky trial has come up. So if you want to talk about that, if you were molested as a boy, how it affected you, what kind of life you've led as a result, because what happened was I had about 10 guys on that day, and they were mind-blowing. People couldn't believe that show. It was Monday. I don't know when it was. And I know that if 10 people called, there's 1,000 more who've thought about calling, and there's at least 100 more of you who will call right now to be heard anonymously and get rid of your pain. Just shell it out. You know what I'm saying? What else is in the news? Well, I don't know what else. What's in the news? Who knows already? Again, listen. You want to talk? You know what I really want to talk about is I'd like to also talk about Syria, because you don't know what to think about Syria. You're confused by Syria. You're being deceived by the United Nations and the American press about Syria. And you see, whichever side you take, you're going to feel you're wrong. It's impossible to take a side in the civil war. However, if you know what happened in Libya, and if you know what happened in Egypt, you can pretty much understand that the major media is being stampeded by the Islamists into believing that the rebels are the saints, and the dictator, Assad, who is as brutal as they come, is the real bad guy. He's evil. He's bad. Put it down. Michael Savage said Assad is evil and bad, but the rebels are worse. They are Islamists. They want to drive out or kill all the Christians in Syria who are being protected by Assad. You don't know that. And attention, Jewish liberals. Once again, as brilliant as you may think you are, you know nothing. Once again, you know nothing. All you know is what Spielberg puts in your brain. You don't know anything. The Jews in Syria are being protected by Assad, which is why the UN wants the Islamists to win. You schmucks. When are you going to wake up? You expect a rabbi to tell you this? The rabbi doesn't know what's going on. What does he know? What does he know? Again, you're on the wrong side of history. Again, the wrong side of history. So let me repeat so I'm not misquoted again. And although I'm banned in England and banned in San Francisco, I don't want to be banned anywhere else. Assad is a brutal, murderous dictator. The Islamists are worse. Which side are you on? Mubarak, our best friend in the Middle East for 40 years. The best friend made peace with Israel. You cheered when Anderson Cooper got excited about the boys with tight dungarees holding blackberries. You idiots, you. You boarded hook, line, and sinker because Obama and Hillary Clinton and the others told you that there was an Arab Spring, when in fact it's the opposite. It's an Arab disaster. Of course Mubarak was a dictator. Now what do you have there now? Something better? The libraries have been ransacked. The country is in chaos. The Coptic Christians are being killed and driven out of their churches. You don't read about that because the vermin in the media hate Christians. You don't understand something about the communists, do you? You don't know how the communists think. They don't even know they're communists, half of them in this country. They'd laugh at you if you called them a communist. But let me tell you something. Anybody who's into income redistribution is a communist. Anybody's into wanting a government to control you from cradle to grave is a communist. Let me help you define the people in the media a little bit more. If you'd like me to, I'll be glad to do it. But I don't want to get distracted. I'm not going to get distracted because I'm going to stay very focused on what I'm telling you. You are being snookered in a way you can never even imagine. Obama, Jimmy Carter, Zbigniew Brzezinski with Soros' money and organization. He's the peso novante. Soros is the peso novante who pulls the strings on these buffers. And Soros, for some reason, is the most demonic man in the world, so far as I can tell. A Jewish refugee from the Nazis is in favor of Islamists in Egypt and in Libya? Explain that one to me. Tell me how that one works and why. Explain why Soros and Carter and Brzezinski are on the side of the Islamists. Explain that to me, along with Hillary Clinton and Obama. Then let's talk about Syria. Or if you'd rather not talk about something like Syria, we can talk about, were you molested, stage set for the upcoming lecture series. The question is 1-800-449-8255. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Talking to small employers and big employers, and I hear day in and day out, they feel this administration sees them as their enemy. They feel that the Obama policies have made it harder for them to put people back to work.
Well, that's right.
Almost
Romney's, okay, that's enough, but Romney's making sense. Everyone I know who actually employs people says the same thing. This is an anti-business administration. I mean, let's be clear here. As tepid as Romney is, he's saying it like it is. Came out today that Steven Spielberg may be behind Obama's failed Bain Capital attack. That's right. You know how I constantly ridicule Katzenberg, Hatzenberg, Matzenberg, Ratzenberg, and Spielberg? Was I wrong? Am I wrong when I tell you it's Katzenberg, Hatzenberg, Ratzenberg, Matzenberg, and Spielberg who are behind this administration? I know of what I speak. I know that it was Katzenberg, Ratzenberg, Hatzenberg, Matzenberg, and Spielberg who, before you ever heard the name Obama, were raising money for him in Hollywood in 2007. I know people who live in Beverly Hills who told me it was Katzenberg, Ratzenberg, Hatzenberg, Matzenberg, and Spielberg who were pushing this man. So now it turns out that Steven Spielberg, perhaps the worst director in American history, created the fantasy that the man who knows more about capitalism than Obama, who is Romney, doesn't know anything about capitalism. That's the man who created a movie such as War Horse and The Adventures of Tintin, Indiana Jones 4. There was a time that Spielberg made good movies. I was a fan of one of his movies, maybe two, but I think that the man, by and large, has lost his touch. But nevertheless, here it comes out that you have these domos in the film business who go to bankers for financing. They need financing, they need corporate investment, they need shady sources of money to make their movies, and now they attack Romney in ads over Bain Capital. And who did it? Katzenberg, Katzenberg, Ratzenberg, Matzenberg, and Spielberg. That's why I tell you, it's insanity. Look, I created the phrase, liberalism is a mental disorder, and I see it on the blogs all the time where they say, well, liberals are insane, mentally disordered, liberals, no one even knows I created it. That's all. I got loads of molester callers, people who were molested, which, I don't want to exploit it, but it's a heck of a show, I got to tell you. So let's start with one of them. New York WOR Moses, go ahead, please tell your story.
Yeah, first of all, Michael Savage, I've been here for the last 3 years, man, and you're more than a therapist could do, because I've been seeing a therapist for being molested. I was 12 years old and stuff.
Yeah.
How it happened. Like, I'm 56.
How you were 12? How old are you now?
I'm 56 years old, and I've been off heroin for the last 3 years.
Okay, you know? But wait a minute. Hold on. You were molested at 12. Who did it to you?
Who did it? This guy did it. Because I was living in Brooklyn, Parksville, Brooklyn. That's 3rd Avenue up there, 19th Street.
All right, so what are you calling to say? It affected you every day of your life, Moses?
Yeah, it still affects me now, but, like, you know, they give me all this kind of this medication. It doesn't help because it happens.
No. Medication is a fraud. Most of and the drug interactions between medications are very damaging. But that's a separate story. Well, I'm sorry for your plight. There's nothing I can do about it. Let's take the next caller. Boy, I got callers now. Really, you talk about this. It's frightening to see. You know how many wounded people are running around this world, injured when they were children? Amazing to me. The people who are so injured in this world. Sacramento, Richard, go ahead, please. KSTE country, go ahead, please. Richard. He almost got through. Why he left the phone, I don't know. Can only imagine. Pittsburgh, PA. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Savage. I was a victim of molestation when I was about 12 years old by a friend of the family who made himself, he was a very close friend of the family. And it did affect me greatly for the first part of my adult life. I got into a lot of drugs and a lot of alcohol. But I learned to deal with it, and I got into counseling, and I went to NA and AA and got help for my problems, and I've actually used it as a learning tool, actually, because it has taught me how to defend myself against anybody who has negative effects towards me, if that makes any sense to you.
How do you defend yourself against people trying to hurt you?
I go within myself, and I just have to learn to,
you don't have a clear answer. I mean, I'm not trying to put you on the spot. People are still hurting you is what it comes down to, Kevin. And what you have to understand is that when you're feeling hurt, you need to get aggressive. You need to get mentally aggressive. You need to hurt them back in your head. Did you hear me, Kevin? I didn't say hurt them physically, but you need to get aggressive in your head when you feel vulnerable. That's right. Counterintuitive, huh?
Savage.
It's one of those days. I'm even going to my bookmarks on my computer. There's nothing in the news. I mean, it's horrible news, but you don't want to hear any of it. Just horrible. It's unbelievable to me what's going on in the world, but you don't want to talk about it. I mean, I asked you to call if you were molested truthfully because it's fascinating, but, you know, it is exploitive in a way to have people call up and tell us their pain. If you actually look at what's going on in the world's aflame since Obama took office. We had allies in the Middle East. They're no longer our ally. The world is in upheaval. The economy's in shambles. And yet, the man could go to a fundraiser in New York at $40,000 a head and with the same breath tell you he's for the poor. That he's for the poor, the less than 0.1%. And you can believe it. It just shows you that you can fool most of the people most of the time. Let's put it that way. Lincoln may have said one thing, but Savage says another. I'll change Lincoln's phrase of you can fool some of the people sometimes, some people all the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. I'll change Lincoln's address to this. You can fool most of the people most of the time, given that the media is owned by the politician who is fooling the people most of the time. That's all going on. SF couple kills daughter's alleged pimp, cops say. SF couple killed daughter's pimp, cops say. Bicyclist charged in pedestrian death. Took him only 2 months to charge him. Sped through an intersection and killed a 92-year-old man in the Castro district. They finally charged him. I was in San Francisco yesterday. I'm not there today. I don't know anymore. I love the city. I don't love the city. I love it, but I don't love it. I don't like the bums. I don't like the bicyclists. Let's see, what else I don't like about San Francisco and what I do like. I got sick from the greasy Chinese food. There must be something wrong with me if I am unable to eat the Chinese food. I mean, I normally eat bad Chinese food for years. But I finally got sick from it. I mean, I joke about it. It was horrible. I mean, chicken? There must have been an ounce of chicken in the whole dish, chopped up little pieces. That's to begin with. You got to be insane. You go to Safeway for $8.99, you can get a whole... I don't understand it. But I'm addicted to the place. I go in there. The food quality is going down across America. Have you noticed? Italian food. You know where they're cutting on Italian food? Mark my words. Tell me if I'm wrong. They're cutting back on the sauce. Why? Tomatoes are expensive. So that's where Tony is getting you. That's where Tony is getting you. He's cutting. You mark my words. Especially if you get takeouts. If you get a takeout pasta dish, you're getting reamed on the sauce. They're cutting it in half. Because the sauce is expensive. That's the way it is. So what are you going to do? Stay home? Everyone eats in restaurants. There's no other outlet in the country. Make noise. They scream. You get a drink, two drinks of cheap rot-gut wine in them. Cheap rot-gut wine, and they start screaming in restaurants. I can't take it. I feel like wearing headphones in restaurants. The screamers drive me crazy, the women. You put two Chardonnays in them, two cheap California Chardonnays, which is nothing but sugar water with a little grape in it, and they get hysterical, screaming. My teeth are on edge like chalk on a blackboard. What else do you want to hear? I don't want to do politics. It's Thursday already. It's hot again. I thought it was cool. It was hot. I was in San Francisco yesterday, so I met an old friend of mine. I still talk to one old friend of mine. And we're walking in the streets after the show, and there was fog on the bay, but we turned the corner, and there was sun out. I thought I was in like a Miami Beach set. His face looked like it was on fire. And we had to run under the shadow of a tall building. I said, look at you. I feel like I'm talking to you in Magic City. In that circa 1961 on Collins Avenue. It was shocking. San Francisco is not supposed to be like this. It's like the day the earth stood still. Yeah, I know, it's global warming, right? Every million years there's a cyclic change. So Al Gore can capitalize on the cyclic change. He's smart enough to look at paleological history and come up with a scam. He sold it to all the gonoffs in the university business. You know, he smeared them with enough grants, they all believe in the man-made global warming. So what do you want to talk about? Do you want to talk about medications, molestations, protestations, declarations? Anything is fair game. Let's go to the callers. Okay, Eric on Waco, Texas. Go ahead, please. You're on the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, I have an idea for your live event.
Yes.
when you do your live event, you should broadcast it live. Do a radio show as your live event.
What do you mean? Don't do a live event on stage?
No, do it on stage, and then as you're on stage, have the show being broadcast as that day's radio show. So you're doing your radio show.
What you mean put it on my website?
Well, you could do that. You could do it that way, but you
and
could
what
also,
give it out for free or charge for it?
Well, either way, but, you know, if...
What do you mean, either way? I mean, what promoter's going to put all that money into a stage show and then let you sell it and give it away for nothing? You can't do that. You have to... It's a business like anything else, Eric.
I understand that, but...
In other words, if I have a large concert promoter willing to take Michael Savage and put him on stage, right, why would they want to have me put it out on the air for free?
Well, being there is way different than listening to it.
All right, thank you very much. Here we go again. The Obama voters want it for nothing. How come Obama doesn't appear at a fundraiser for free? He could say, well, it's $40,000 ahead, but we're doing it for nothing today. How come Obama doesn't give a speech? He doesn't belch without getting paid. He doesn't yawn. Michelle doesn't use the salt shaker without getting paid for it in public. I never saw anything like this. Now, it is true I could run it on the internet the next day on my website on a pay-per-view basis. It's like the Pacquiao fight a day later. You know, you can't do it when you're doing a live show because then people would stay home rather than go see you. Actually, that's an interesting question, by the way. I want to ask a question. It's about sporting events and about live speed. This is a very intriguing question. If you go to a ball game, is it different than watching it on television? Yes. Yeah, but how different? Is it better? What do you like about it? Tell me what part of going to a ball game you like better than sitting at home and watching a baseball game. Let's see. You like being around people you've tried to avoid all your whole life. You like being threatened by people in the stands, people you would normally never in a million years come in contact with. Let's see, you enjoy that. You enjoy getting caught in gridlock on the way to the stadium. You enjoy paying $25 for a parking spot. You enjoy paying $19 for popcorn and $12 for soda. You enjoy paying $13 for a bad chili dog. What is it? You like getting a sunburn in the stands. You enjoy the screaming idiot next to you. Let's see, you enjoy the woman in front of you with so much perfume that you feel as you're going to check yourself into Bellevue Hospital from a chemical overdose. So now the same is true with like a boxing match. Let's say I go to Vegas, and I've gone a few times and watched a boxing match, and I'm in the front rows. Okay, so what do you get to see? The blood hitting you in the face? You miss getting hit with the sweat? What are you getting there? That you could see the box is better on television. Now let's go to Michael Savage giving a talk. I'm going to appear live. Wouldn't you rather see me live rather than not see me on television? It's a complete reversal from what I just said. What are you going to see with me on a stage that you wouldn't see if I was on the internet? It's a reversal. It's a complete reversal. A complete and total reversal. And you have to figure out why. I actually don't know why, but I'm trying to ask people why they go to any live event. I have no idea. I try to stay away from everything. If I could, I would never see another person for the rest of my life except my immediate family. And even that I would limit to a minimal amount. I don't know what it is. I'm trying to look up, like, there's a syndrome about this. Some kind of mental or physical syndrome. But if I look back on my life, I can't say I've always been this way. There was a time when I liked people and I was popular, etc. I was like the shortstop. I was the announcer. Everyone liked me. I don't know. I'm painted myself into a corner with talk radio. It's an isolating profession. And you sit alone. You're probably imagining I'm in a studio surrounded by an entourage of 15. You're great, man. No one here. Zero. The dog isn't even here today. I'm absolutely alone. The crew is in another state. I'm alone in a room. I have a microphone and computer screens. A prisoner at San Quentin has a better social life than I. In fact, I was considering committing a crime in order to get arrested, because at least I would have people pay attention to me. I'd have more friends. I could have therapy. They could try to build up my self-esteem. They'd find out why I don't feel good. I'd have constant attention, good dental care, good medical care, group meetings, pinball. I could make movies. I could learn a useful skill for when I get out of jail. I'd have guys to schmooze with day and night. It's a great life in many ways compared to most of us working stiffs, don't you think? I bet many people have thought what I just said. Many of you have watched these shows on prison life, and you said, you know what, I envy them in a way, because they all have friends. They sit around all day long. They talk to each other. I never saw anything like it. In some cases, prison in America looks like it's a social club. They have no responsibilities whatsoever. They don't even have to learn geometry. It's like a bad high school in Queens with no learning required. Three meals on top of it all, uniforms, clothing. A lot of people see it that way. I'm not kidding you. When I was a kid, for example, my dad had a store in a poor neighborhood. Now it's not a poor neighborhood anymore. But so he says, well, look at the poor, unfortunate alcoholics from the Bowery. They'd come over. Oh, I hated looking at them. It was awful, the bums. They were known as Bowery bums. Today they're known as members of the Bloomberg administration. They washed them up and gave them a suit. They generally worked for one of the governmental agencies. In those days, they were known as Bowery bums. Now they work for the government in one form or another. They'd be laying in the street. It was very sad. So he would say to me, you see these guys? He said, they sleep in the street in the summer. I said, what? I said, well, what about those flop houses, 50 cents a night? He says, nah. He said, they'd rather save the 50 cents on the room and buy more cheap alcohol. He said, well, watch what they do in the winter. He said, in the winter, you'll notice the streets are empty. I said, so where do they go? He said, well, many of them do stay in the flop houses, and some of them will throw a rock through a window to get arrested. I said, what? He said, yeah, because the jail is warm and they get free food. So, you see, I learned about life 101. I didn't have to go to school to learn about life in the streets. I didn't read about it in a Harvard magazine. I didn't read about it in a sociology magazine, these morons. I listened to them on television. I'm shocked. I saw a Putz yesterday on NPR with Judy Woodbrain. I couldn't believe what I was watching with a picture of the Sather Tower at Berkeley behind them. You know, I have a real PhD. And look at the guy. You could see everything in a man by how his mouth moves. Let me put it to you that way. When I listen to a man talk, I don't just listen to him. I watch his mouth. And let me leave it at that, because it's a family show. So the way the guy's mouth moved told me he didn't know what he was talking about. And on, in love with himself about giving back and noblesse oblige, and how he teaches students about if you've been given benefits in life in a great society, you have to give back, and how the rich people don't give back, and on and on and on. And Judy Woodbrain sat there, So what, are you crazy? I'm paying over 50% of every dollar I make in income taxes, state, local, federal. I'm not giving back. I'm not giving back. If you want to give back your tenured job, you schmendrick. Give back your tenured professorship at Berkeley. All of these lousy communist professors, they make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year with benefits, and all they do is bellyache and hate the country. No good. America, no good. Rich, no good. What are they living on? They're living on working men like me. Who's paying their salary, the schmucks? The illegal aliens aren't paying for their bloated pensions and their bloated salaries. So they go to Thailand and molest children. They do a sociological study on, I can't say it's a public show, but I could tell you what some of these studies are. The same sociology professors. They're going to study like the life of a hooker in Thailand. You hear, and they get a $300,000 grant for that. To study prostitution in Thailand. They said, well, what are you, you spent money in a bar, in a prostitute's bar in Thailand? Yes, I was studying how alcohol is associated with prostitution in Thailand. And if there was some way to cut back on alcohol, we could definitely cut back on prostitution. That costs $3 million. That's an example of what you get out of the University of California today. That's what you get for your money. Anyway, to come back to what I was talking about, I got a little sidetracked, which is good. You're supposed to. It means I'm warming up. It's very slow. It's hard for me to warm up now. I mind, I'm very distracted with a lot of things that are plaguing me right now. But at the end of the day, I'll destroy the evil that's trying to destroy me. It shall be punished. It shall be destroyed. The evil that is trying to destroy me will be found out, exposed, and destroyed. And when it is, I will tell you the whole story when the time comes. And you will not believe the evil that I am dealing with. Jason in Sacramento, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yes, I would go to a sports or see you actually talking in your show just out of respect. You know, it's not about the people. It's about how you make that, you know, like make me feel about the choices I make. And if you were coming to
town. Wow. So in other words, you're a loyal fan who would attend the speech to thank me for being on the air for you. Is that it, more or less? No answer.
I would be.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right, so it's a way of saying thank you. Is that what you're saying?
Basically, like, I'm not a big reader, and I bought all your books, and that's simply out of respect as well, you know? I
wow.
Will eventually read
well, you know, it really touches me. I'll tell you the truth. You know, you can be cynical in this business up to a point, and then you realize that there are people like you out there who are dependent upon on a person such as I. You rely upon me. You count on me. You listen to me. I'm your daily bread in many ways. And it's very touching, Jason. Let me send you a free copy of Trickle Down Tyranny. I don't know what to do. I'm touched by that. You know, this is why you do live events, is to see people who, you know, want to see you. It's better than the Friars Club. Speaking of the Friars Club, it's sad Jerry Lewis, like, had an event, an incident at the Friars. Why would Jerry Lewis want to give an award to Tom Cruise? That's the part that I didn't understand. Jerry Lewis, I could see getting an award at the Friars Club. But Tom Cruise? What is that all about? Why would they give Tom Cruise an award? The guy hasn't done a decent movie, I think, since Born on the 4th of July. You know, I mean, I'm not a big fan of Tom Cruise to begin with, but I'm not a pretty boy kind of, you know, in the actors. I like the gnarled face myself. I always like character actors. I don't like perfect faces. But nevertheless, I don't think he's a particularly good actor. But why would Jerry Lewis give an award to Tom Cruise? But they said low blood sugar, and he didn't take his he has diabetes, and I hope he does well. I always loved Jerry Lewis. I saw him at the Browns Country Club when I was a wee lad. And you know what I was shocked? You were talking about a personal appearance. As a kid, I liked Jerry Lewis because he acted like a kid, like a stupid, dumb kid. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, kids like adults who look like idiots because they don't feel all children feel like idiots. Let's start with that. Most children feel like idiots all the time in an adult world. So when they see an adult acting like a child, they think, oh, look, there's an adult like me. He's an idiot like me. So there's a hope for me yet. I'll grow up and be just like him. And I'll be able to, you know, go on a stage. So, you know, you see that. Now I run into the guy in real life. I actually go to see him. I'm a little kid. And I'm shocked. He's about 6 foot tall, good looking, and brawny. I said, how in the world can this guy pretend to be such a schmendrick? See, it just shows you. Sometimes seeing a person in public, a person in reality isn't so great. I'll be back.
Savage.
Oh, when is this election going to end? Can we speed it up? Can we petition the government to redress our grievances? Can we say end it now? Can we say hold the election on July 4th? Can we say win and take all? Can we say throw the bums out? Can we say replace them with inmates at San Quentin? They couldn't do any worse. How much can we take of this? How much more can we take? It's not thrilling anymore. I think this is all part of the scam to make you think that you have a choice. Okay. New Hampshire. Laura, welcome. You're on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Dr. Savage, for taking my call. I just wanted to say I would happily drive 7.5 hours to New York City to see you.
Why?
Because I think it would be a thrill to see you in person. I've been listening to you for 4 or 5 years now, and you're one of a kind, and you're just, well, you're a gem.
But you're always going to be disappointed. No one is who you think they are. So, in other words, you can't wait to see me on stage to say, I want to see the man behind the voice, but you can go on my website and see what I look like.
Right. But it's different seeing somebody in person.
How?
It's just more exciting, and I think being with the crowd and just seeing everyone all...
Ah, now you're talking. I'll tell you what I've noticed over the years. The crowd is also a big part of the show because you're around like-minded friends. You'll see that you're not alone in the world. You'll see people who think the way you think, and you'll see that they're normal, average people just like you. That's what people get from these events. It's being around a community that they know exists, but they rarely see. You know, you've touched on a raw nerve there, Laura. I actually forgot that that's what people used to love about my live events, my compassionate conservative events. When I return, send her a free copy of Trickle Down Tyranny. I want everyone to get a good gift today because it's the best anti-Obama book ever written. Shh, don't tell him. I hope he doesn't hear this. I hope he's busy raising money. Mr. Obama, I hope that you do very well tonight. And this is the Savage Nation.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Yeah. Do you think it has had a negative influence on culture in any way?
No, totally positive. It's brought the races together. It put Barack Obama in the presidency. You know, if it wasn't for rap, white people wouldn't have been so open to vote for somebody like Barack Obama. But it was hip hop 20 years ago that got people to willing to vote.
Well, I would think because they thought he was a good candidate, not because he was black.
Well, that had to happen after their eyes were opened up, and hip-hop was what brought us together. Mm-hmm. Hip-hop's what took down a lot of those boundaries. Sure. Music did that.
I speak 50 words of English. I speak 50 words of English. I speak 50 words of English. And I got 10 mil in the bank. I speak 50 words of English. And I got 10 mil in the bank, Jank. You speak 100,000 words of English. And you ain't worth jack. Because you ain't got no crack. I speak 50 words of English. And I'm worth 10 mil in the bank, Jank. You speak 100,000 words of English. And you ain't worth jack, crack.
Sorry, I couldn't resist. I was listening to this rapper, this piece of a soundbite of a rapper on some show on television saying that it was rap music that gave us Barack Obama. So I couldn't resist having the guys play my 50 words of English parody. I thought you'd enjoy it. Oh, welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're enjoying the program so far. We're talking about this and that, and I'd like to go to the callers immediately since so many of you have been holding for so long. And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-449-8255. Some call it the greatest show in the history of talk radio. I would tend to agree with them. Ken in Sacramento on KSTE, welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I attended one of your shows about 10 years ago, and I've been waiting a long time to see you again. I hope you come live in the Bay Area.
Well, I am on the 8th, I don't know, September, I'll find it for you in a minute, at the Marin County Civic Center. We're going to do a live performance. Saturday, September 22nd at the Marin County Civic Center. Which show were you at, Ken, and when? Do you know?
I saw the Name 'Em and Shame 'Em show, which was a follow-up to Try 'Em and Fry 'Em.
Oh, my God. Name 'Em and Shame 'Em. Do you remember the venue? Where were we?
You were at the Civic Center, and quite honestly, I still have the poster. I purchased the poster that day.
It's a classic, and I got to tell you something funny. I came up with the phrase "name 'em and shame 'em," and if you remember, we had pictures of we had cardboard cutouts of Hillary Clinton on the stage. Do you remember that?
Yes, and several other politicians.
And several other notable politicians. I think we had a Sox Berger up there, the one who burglarized the National Archives and is now a lobbyist for China. All of the good folks in government were on the stage in cardboard. But my event was called "Name 'Em and Shame 'Em," and you want to hear something ironic? And I'm using the correct word. When I was banned from entering England by the illegitimate bastards in England who put my name on the list, internal documents said we're going to name them and shame them. We're going to name them and shame them. Somebody in the U.S. was in cahoots with the illegitimate in England. Do you know that? No, I think I know who it was, Ken.
Yeah, that is ironic.
Yeah. They took my exact words and got even with me for putting their poster on the stage, Ken. You got to understand there are some very powerful people out there who really don't like Michael trying to destroy me. But, hey, it's in God's hands at a certain point. That's all I can say. So will you come down from Sacramento to the Marin Civic Center on September 22nd?
Absolutely. I'm still a card-carrying Paul Revere Society member.
Oh, my goodness. You're one of the originals.
It's in
well,
my
Ken,
hand.
you got a pleasant surprise coming, which is a copy of Trickle Down Tyranny. Now let's go to the other area. By the way, we could do news. There's loads of news out there. I mean, I don't know if you want to hear any of it. You want a little bit of Romney? You want to hear a little Romney, or it gets you weak? I don't know. Speak softly and carry a big stick. Speak softly and carry no stick. Some pulp, no pulp, more pulp, less pulp. It's like going to buy orange juice. The same thing with a candidate. They don't know whether to have pulp, no pulp, some pulp, more pulp. Romney's being told appear as a pulpless candidate. And he says, well, people today are like a natural juice, so put some pulp in an occasional speech. Well, how about if we give them an entire orange? And no, because then it's too much pulp and they can't digest it. Then the next speech is no pulp. It's like I bought orange juice, Tropicana. So the container says some pulp. Then the other says no pulp. The other says lots of pulp. It's amazing to me how they did, the demographics now. I wonder if you broke it. I wonder if you broke it down by Democrat versus conservative versus liberal. Who wants more pulp in their orange juice? It's an interesting one. It's a hard one to call on that one, honestly. I think Democrats are health fanatics, and they want a lot of pulp. I'm not sure though, and conservatives. It's very hard to define that one. But I think it's the same thing as buying orange juice as buying a candidate. Some pulp, no pulp, lots of pulp. Like they were sold out of the lots of pulp in my local market, so I had to take a no pulp. And I felt like I was cheating myself every time I drank the orange juice because I know I was being denied the pulp, which contains most of the beneficial nutrients, aside from a little vitamin C in the sugar water there. Okay, I only buy sugar-free products. But if you're buying orange juice without pulp, what are you getting? It's like sugar water with a little vitamin C, fundamentally. So instead of being sucrose, so it's fruit sugar, it's fructose. So the pulp is the whole thing. That's the fiber. Everyone knows that. So that was sold out, and it's a very liberal area I live in. So that's my conclusion. Liberals buy more pulp. A pulp full orange juice, the liberals buy it. Conservatives are afraid of pulp. It somehow threatens their colon. It's it goes back to the sorry, I'm getting distracted here. No, I would think that a conservative, when you say conservative, like conservative, I think of a guy like in a Western hat with a string tie with cowboy boots from Arizona in the 60s. That's a conservative, like really rednecked and, you know, tan, like a Barry Goldwater is a conservative. You don't envision conservatives for what, I mean, they you know, it's really stereotypical. But that kind of guy, that cowboy, if he even drinks orange juice, it's got to be no pulp, I would think. Because if he has like pulp would somehow threaten his colon health. Who's in the colon colon cleaning? That's a liberal thing. As a conservative, would never, ever go for that the colon enema thing. That's a very liberal thing. That was very big in the 70s in the health food, in the health doctoring world. Coffee enemas. Remember that phase? Insane. Totally insane. Anyone listening to the show, do you remember the 70s when quack doctors were administering coffee enemas? You remember that? Now, I was a new doctor of nutrition at the time with a PhD from Berkeley, so I was very rational in a field full of quacks, and I advised against coffee enemas. And people said, why? I gave them reasons why, rational reasons why, which I can't repeat here on the, I mean, I can, it's not, there's nothing off color about it. Forget about the mechanics of the coffee enema. Let's put that aside. That unto itself is one thing, but that's nothing new. I mean, the enema has been around a long time. That was once very big in the Victorian era. But the idea of injecting such a high dose of caffeine into your colon worried me, frankly. It's like I was totally opposed. I'm going to show you something. Let's start with the rational. Then we'll get into the comedic and then the political. During the phase, the heyday of calcium as a supplement, I was opposed to it. Ask anybody. I was a leader in the field, and I was very cautious about telling people. I told people, don't use calcium supplements. Don't use them at all. And they said, why, doctor, why? I said, because you're taking a form of calcium that may not wind up in your bones. It may wind up in your arteries. They looked at me like I was nuts. Now, remember what I'm talking about, the 70s, when I was writing books such as Nutrition Against Aging, Maximum Immunity in 82, 83. So even common sense was not present in the health food movement or the nutrition movement at that time. It was filled with extremists. And most of them, I was thinking about them today, they're all fanatic. 99% of them are fanatic liberals. Even though they don't understand, it's the liberals in Congress who want to destroy the health food industry. Here's another example. The people who live on the vitamin in the vitamin industry are phenomenally left-wing, even though they don't realize that it's the left-wing that wants to regulate them out of business. Now, go figure that one out. Because I can name them. I remember them. I was thinking about them today. People I knew in the 70s in this field. All phenomenal left-wing Colorado Democrats, California Democrats. They don't even realize that their best allies are the conservatives and the libertarians who want to leave them alone because, you know, give people some freedom of choice in medicine. They have no idea what they're doing. They're stuffed with vitamins and marijuana. They haven't any idea what's going on around them. It's the marijuana destroyed the whole society. And now we're finished altogether with the legalization under the guise of medical marijuana. The country's finished. It's over. And who pushed it? You see, I know this. I know who pushed medical marijuana as a concept in two states. That's right. The most evil man in the history of the world. In the most evil man in the history of American politics, in my opinion, is George Soros. That's a political opinion. And I argued with one of his spokesmouths about 10 years ago when they were trying to push a ballot initiative in California and in Arizona to legalize marijuana under the guise of medical marijuana. I said, all you're trying to do is dope up the population so you can manipulate them. You know I'm right. Intuitively, the minute I said it, you knew I was right. Now I'll get the callers. You know it's good. I have cancer and I'm doing better. I heard all of that. And take Marinol. Take the active principle. You're doing it because you get to smoke dope in public and insult people. Mainly, the 99% of the people who are using medical marijuana that I know in San Francisco that I see, let me qualify it. A large majority of those using medical marijuana in San Francisco, amongst the people I have noticed, do it to offend people and to get high in public. That's my statement on the issue. Okay, write that one down. See if you can sue me for saying it, for giving you my opinion on the issue. I mean, what is talk radio about? Is it not? This is what I don't understand. I am in talk radio. I'm not on NPR. NPR is like, now let's go. Okay? Everything is quiet and everything is like undercurrents. Talk radio is brazen. It's out there. It's overt. It's opinionated. It's meant to shock you. Not solely shock you, but I have to make statements that shock you. Isn't that correct? So how can you crucify me for shocking you with a statement like that I just made? Huh? How can you do that? And yet every day of the week, people try to crucify Michael Savage for saying things in a medium in which he's supposed to say things he believes to be true. Okay? After all, I'm not a philosopher. If you read the periodicals who write about me, I am what they say I am. I'm a shock jock. You can't take me seriously. The real serious journalists are people like John King on CNN or Dan Rather. He was a great serious journalist. Or Tom Brokaw. I mean, he was a serious journalist, wasn't he? Or Friedman from the New York Times. Now, there's a serious journalist, isn't he? No, I'm just a shock jock. So why are you shocked by the statements I make? I'll be right back.
Savage.
Anything but the campaign. Welcome back to the Savage Nation. Unless something happens, why am I going to talk about it? I wish it were over. Could I vote early? Can I vote early and repeatedly? Because that's what the Democrats are doing. That's what Eric Holder's entire job is, to make certain that as many illegal aliens vote as often as possible. And he dares to say to the states that are trying to stop them from being on the voter rolls that they're somehow racist. It's fattening. It's illegal. It's immoral. It's fattening. How dare you take people from Mexico off the rolls just by dint of the fact that a larger percentage of those that you took off the rolls were from Haiti and Florida indicates you're a racist. Now, does that make sense to you? Could it indicate that the largest number of fraudulent voters are Haitian in Florida, not that the largest number of people who were taken off because of racism? Is that possible? Or his mind doesn't work that way? The answer is when the mind it alters all. William Blake wrote that. So if your mind is structured so that you see everything as racist, you see everything as racist. If your entire life has been built upon the premise that you're living in a white racist society, even though you're president, or that you're attorney general, but the whole world is out to get you, but now you're the top cop in the country, but you still think it's a racist world, then does that make you a whack job? Does it make the world racist? You have to figure that one out. Pennsylvania, Kevin, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Dr. Savage, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on what you'd said about coffee enemas and the people that do colon cleanser.
You want to comment on what I said about coffee enemas?
Yes.
Oh, okay, go on, because some people didn't even hear you. Tell us about coffee enemas, if you will.
There's a book out. It was written by a former Navy urologist, Balkenbach. It's called Prescription to Nutritional Healing. And in the part there that talks about dietary fasting, it says how our bodies go through cycles, and periodically they build up toxins. Why not, instead of overloading your body with food, give all your organs a rest? And it talks about the coffee enema and how coffee in that way stimulates the liver to throw off toxic bile.
Have you tried coffee enemas?
Of course.
And what has it done for you?
Well, here you go. 4 years ago, when I was 48, as far as health-wise, I swam 5,000 meters nonstop. I can get into a pool, health-wise, I'm a great...
Whoa. 5 years... I mean, I can't hear you. 5 years ago, you did a coffee enema, and what happened?
No. As part of my keeping my body clean, coffee enema being part of a fasting cleanse, I'm healthy, I'm on my game, I'm alert, I can go long without rest, my people at my work, I'm 52 years old, I work circles and go, and they can't believe it. And I don't tell them.
But you ascribe all of this energy to coffee enemas?
Sure, because it helps your liver get rid of toxic bile, and the liver is the filter of the body. That's part of it. There's other parts of it as well, but a colon cleanse...
How do you account for the fact that primitive man often lived long and healthy and was virile without coffee enemas? How do you explain that?
Well, I don't know about that. I'm just talking about for me what works for me.
So, in other words, if Abraham had a coffee enema, he would have lived to 200 instead of 120. If Moses had coffee enemas, he'd still be with us. In other words, come on. I don't know. Look, it's an individualistic thing. I just say drink 3 cups of coffee a day, and take it in through your mouth, and let it go at that. Okay? I don't know. There's something about the. That's all. Next case.
Set.
Clip 10. Clip 10, Romney. Let's go to clip 10.
If you look at his record over the last 3.5 years, you will conclude, as I have, that it is the most anti-investment, anti-business, anti-jobs series of policies in modern American history.
Okay, now he's talking. Now that's orange juice with lots of pulp. That's lots of pulp. See, if Romney gives us sound bites that are filled with pulp, lots of pulp, he'll win. However, if he goes back to the no pulp Romney, the no pulp speeches were finished. For example, clip 7 is a no pulp. Let's hear clip 7, no pulp.
Over the last several months, he has been going across the country attempting to convince the American people that he's turning around.
Stop there. See, that's no pulp. Now, go to clip 10 again. You'll see lots of pulp.
If you look at his record over the last 3.5 years, you will conclude, as I have, that it is the most anti-investment, anti-business, anti-jobs series of policies in modern American history.
See, that's lots of pulp. See, that's a talk radio soundbite. You repeat the thing over and over again. You make your point. But if you get too roundabout, people lose it. I'm going to show you like pulp, no pulp, some pulp, lots of pulp in various and sundry pieces of sound. Here's Mayor Napoleon Bloomberg defending his ban on large sugary drinks in clip 13. Let's hear clip 13.
You attract enormous attention for what you're trying to do in health. There was smoking. There was trans fat. Now there is sugar and sugary drinks. What is this? What is it that drives?
Charlie, stop right. Charlie Rose is a pimp for the establishment. No one listens to him except politicians. He goes to the Bilderberg meeting. He's a propagandist for the Bilderbergs. Let's put it to you that way. A propagandist for the power structure. He is the establishment's mole and mouthpiece. No pulp. Now let's listen to Bloomberg. Let's hear if he has pulp.
Okay. We're not here to tell anybody what to do, but we certainly have an obligation to tell them what's in the best science and best medicine says is in their interest.
Sugar seems to. Whoa! But you are. You want to outlaw the drink? What are you? See, here it is lying. See, here's Bloomberg got caught with his pants down. The man has no problem at all with certain, let us say, illicit substances being legalized in the city, but he's attacking sugar and caffeine. Here, play another Bloomberg.
Sugar seems to have gotten a bigger attention when you start talking about sugary drinks and the size of the drink and, you know, the big magazine, these big newspaper pictures of you as nanny.
Yeah, but that's just because it's the story of the week. That'll get blended into lots of other things.
No, it won't get blended into a lot of other things. You're going to be remembered for being the putz who attacked soda. That's what you're going to be remembered for. That's the history of you. In other words, if you look back on the history of New York mayors, they're usually caricatured by one image that sticks forever. Giuliani will be remembered, for better or for worse, for 9/11. Bloomberg will be seen forever as a Napoleonic figure with a large sugary, a cup of sugary juice, a sugary soda, with a sugary soda cup. If I were a cartoonist, I would show a gigantic cup of sugary soda with a little mayor pointing at it saying, "You're banned." That would be the cartoon that I would draw. Tiny figure of a little mayor pointing at a finger with a cup of soda 10 times his size saying, "You're out of here. You're banned." That's how it'll be remembered for the next 100 years. No, it's not going to be forgotten. With all the problems in New York City, the murders, the crimes, the rapes, the drug dealing, and I have to go on and on, you're attacking a soda? As I said, you're going to ban big sodas. Why don't you ban Jeroboam's of wine, Mr. Bloomberg? I mean, by the same logic, you say you want to defend, you want to help people. Health-wise, I don't drink sugary soda myself, but that's my personal choice. But if I were poor and I was at a ball game and I went with a family of six, let's say, and I didn't have unlimited money as you do, Mr. Bloomberg, I'd buy the largest soda I could at the lowest possible price. Likewise, the largest tub of popcorn at the lowest possible price instead of small portions that look very good on the Upper East Side. Tiny little portions. Like at a museum opening where you might serve popcorn to be like, you know, daring, but it would be in a small cup, like a mini cup to show, oh, how cute. Look, he's serving a prole drink. He's serving a parole food item, popcorn in an art opening at the Metropolitan Museum, but it's in a small portion to show you're cool. But the poor guy buys a big portion because it's cheaper. So the only motivation you have here, in my opinion, is that you're catering to the caterers, the purveyors, rather, of the sugary drinks and the popcorn people, because they'd rather actually sell smaller drinks at higher prices. That's how it looks to me as an outsider. I don't use any butter on my popcorn. If I eat popcorn, I love corn. It's the greatest thing ever given to us by the people from the region where corn came, and it came from the middle America, as you well know. It's Central America. It was hybridized from a grass. Originally, the corn husk was nothing more than a large husk in a grass, and it was hybridized over a long period of time into corn. And now we have the case where it was one of the healthiest foods on earth, corn, and now you have Napoleon Bloomberg wanting to ban corn. It's unbelievable to me. Here's clip 17. Tell me if this has no pulp, some pulp, or a lot of pulp.
We have gone to a society where everything's fast food, everything's high calories, and the average person today is much heavier than they were. Airlines have a problem that customers can't fit in the seats anymore. Obesity is becoming the single biggest health problem in America, and will kill more people than smoking in a few years.
Why is it that libs hate fat people so much? They're disgusted by fat people. It's actually a physical revulsion they have for the fat. It's anti-obesity is an obsession. It's actually, I would think that a therapist could look into this. It's something to do with being smothered as a child by an overbearing mother. I'm not sure. But it's a fear. It's actually a phobia of fat people. So that's what Bloomberg's worry about, is airlines can't seat fat people. What would he know about that he flies in a private jet? What would he know about it? What, he's obsessed by, he's bothered by a fat guy in an airplane in American Airlines? When has he last been on American Airlines? Obesity is the biggest health problem in America and will kill more people than smoking in a few years. Okay, so that's a personal choice. So, how do we deal with it? You don't legislate away the foods that fat people eat. You educate fat people to not eat such foods. That's how you do it, do you? You don't want to punish fat people. Now, why don't you go to shock? That if you buy one, you actually have to take a shock in the tub. There's a little metallic rod that you have to touch. And the city can have popcorn inspectors in every movie theater. And anyone who buys a large tub of popcorn has to be shocked in order to get it. And if you don't get shocked, you're not entitled to it. That would work. Then you can hire inspectors, popcorn inspectors. You get the shock, and then you can go into shock therapy. Bloomberg popcorn therapy. This is what politicians are worrying about, fat people eating sugary popcorn. I just, it's astounding to me. And defending it, no less. Just defending it. I don't eat that stuff. I don't drink soda with sugar in it. If I drink soda, I avoid it altogether. I drink a diet soda once in a while because I like the aspartame. It's antidepressant. It's very tremendous. It's an unbelievable substance. One of the best natural antidepressants there is like a diet soda, Diet Coke, Diet Pepsi. Amazing. What do you think it's so popular for? Why don't you ban that and make them go buy a Prozac? Maybe your friends in the AMA can tell you that they shouldn't drink diet sodas either, because although it's not about obesity, now you can say NutraSweet's not good for you, because although it hasn't killed any more rats than whatever, than a rat trap, we're going to ban it because we want you to drink nothing at all, water, and take a Prozac pill in a mental hospital. Ah, come on already. Stop legislating everyone's choices here. And why don't you worry about the drug dealing in the city? Why don't you worry about the children on marijuana at Columbia University who are getting stoned and don't know what they're doing? Why don't you pay attention to the most toxic drug in American society, which is marijuana? The biggest killer of the brain in American society is marijuana. The number one destroyer of the logical faculties is marijuana. The biggest killer of lungs in America, along with big tobacco, is big marijuana, Mayor Bloomberg. That's what you should really be doing, I think. That's my opinion. Or you could start banning welfare recipients from buying big tubs of popcorn. You could start with that. You can't spend a welfare stamp on a big soda or a big tub of popcorn. So like I saw a show the other night about a fat guy, a 600-pounder. I don't know where they're coming from. There's an awful lot of them. admittedly, like a sixer, like bigger than a sumo, got stuck in his bathtub. He slipped. He was in there for 3 days. I mean, you can't laugh at it. It's frightening. Someone went in the house. They were trying to fix a pipe, and they hear moaning. And they go, and the poor slob is laying in his own filth in a bathtub. Disgusting. But a part of me says, wait a minute. How does this man get like this? What part of this is self-indulgent, and what part of it requires me now to treat him, transport him, treat him, give him care, give him therapy? He's already on welfare. He's got free housing. He's got free medical care, probably free legal care. The landlord sued because he slipped in a bathtub because the bathtub wasn't big enough for a man 700 pounds. What part of that offends you, I ask myself? Where is it written in the U.S. Constitution that I have to pay for all of the indulgent people in my society? Where is it written? Then not only do I have to pay for them, for their medical services, etc., but I now have to let people vote in my country who are not even citizens because the illegitimate are grinding us down out of Washington now. But it's a question. I'm a shock jock. I'm not as intelligent, for example, as Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw. I certainly am not up to their level. They went to broadcasting schools. They went to journalism schools. I mean, they're really objective. All those guys were really very objective. Well, look at CNN, how objective they are. That's where you turn if you want an objective statement. Me, you don't expect objectivity. I'm just a talk show host. I'm just giving you opinions, one man's opinion. If you don't agree with it, why are you listening? Why are you listening? If you don't agree with me, why are you listening to my show? So if you do agree with me, it means that you agree with a shock jock. That's all. The British call me a shock jock, but they ban me anyway. So I don't understand the logic. Think about that. If I'm only a shock jock, what's so threatening to the English people? Why are they taking me so seriously for if I'm only a shock jock? If I was Schopenhauer and I made those statements that I didn't make, then they could ban me because I'm a dangerous philosopher who people believe. But since I'm only a shock jock who no one believes, why take me seriously and ban me from England and ban me from San Francisco? See how that works? I'll be right back.
Savage.
Crazy time in America. Sandusky sex abuse trial. I mean, it's one thing after another. $40,000 to see Obama. Spielberg behind Obama's Bain Capital attack. I don't know what I'm going to wake up to tomorrow in this crazy world. I could read that Sandusky was found innocent and he was hired by the TSA to advise them on how to screen passengers. Anything's possible. Anything is possible in this country. It seems that common sense has gone out the window. Las Vegas Joe, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I'm a 46-year-old man, and I was molested when I was 9 years old by my stepfather, who is a trusted fireman in the community.
Oh, boy.
And we hear on the news a lot about how, you know, when we hear about these child molesters, they say that the majority of them were molested as children. And I think people tend to think in that direction. And I'd just like to say that I think that the majority of children that are molested don't grow up to be child molesters.
I would agree with you. In fact, I would think that they would grow up to be the opposite because they would never, ever want to do to others what was done to them.
Well, exactly. From my personal point of view, I don't have any children myself, but I've got two great nieces, and a lot of my friends have children, and I look at them in their innocence, and I think to myself, how could some monster take that innocence from a child?
Thank you very much. Every time I look at a child and see their eyes, I think of someone hurting them, I would kill them.
Yeah,
that's what I think of. They should tear them to pieces. Anyone who takes the innocence of a little child should be ripped to shreds. That's what I feel in my heart when I see that. I look, this is how I feel because I had a defenseless brother who couldn't defend himself, and I had to defend him as a child. And I mean, you know, just the thoughts of what happened to him when he was sent to a home and all make me crazy sometimes about what people will do to the innocent.
I totally agree. And, you know,
so I'm going to let it. I don't even want to dwell on it. It gets me too agitated. You know, I think it's the same with a father who abuses a son, is overly harsh, too macho with the child. Sometimes that son will grow up to be a very different kind of father to his own children because he doesn't want to repeat what his father did to him. I know it from personal experience. I know it in my own life. I had an overbearing father who was, frankly, in some ways terrible to me. I mean, I could tell you stories. He never hit me, but psychologically, he did things to me that I didn't like very much. And I remember when I had children, I made up my mind, never, ever, ever will I pull those games on my children. I will never do it. Now, whether I achieve that level, I don't know. I said I will do the opposite of what he did to me. I will never, ever, for example, I'll give you an example. It's a little peek into it because, you know, I tend to glorify the past and glorify, you know, my life. But as I'm writing this book, Train Tracks, some memories are coming back that I'm not too happy with. And they're not about molestation. Don't go off the rails with it. I found a picture of my father, may rest in peace. There's a young man in the Neversink River up in the Catskill Mountains. Neversink River, I always loved that river. Cold and dark. It was the center of my life as a young child in the summers. And a memory comes back to me when I was very young. There was a waterfall that I was afraid of in South Fallsburg, New York. It was, to me, like the Niagara Falls. It isn't, but to this day, it's always struck a huge waterfall down the river. And we were all warned, don't get caught in the current because it'll sweep you over the falls and you'll die. So we swam upriver. So my father put me in an inner tube, and he said, I'm going to push you over the falls. And I started to scream and cry. I thought he was going to that the water would take me down the river and I would die. And he'd start to laugh hysterically as he was pushing me upriver, and the current took me back into his arms. Now, why he would do a thing like that, I haven't any idea. And the fact of the matter is, I'm going to put that story, it's called The Boy in the River, in my book, Train Tracks. But as a result of this kind of small sadism, I made a decision never to torment my children mentally, never. I went out of my way. I bent over backwards to not ridicule them, to not criticize them. Oh, I was a father, all right, and I was strong, but I never, ever used ridicule or scorn on my children when they were young. Never. Never. I avoided it like the plague because I didn't want to do to them what was done to me. So, you know, that's a confessional, you know, and I'm having a lot of difficulty with some of these memories because I don't want to talk about it. But I think it's important in the midst of all of this to, you know, dredge up the dirty laundry, so to speak. Now, why would he do a thing like that? What was he trying to do? Was he just being malicious, or was he trying to toughen me up to not be scared? You can play it either way. It's the Abraham and Isaac story, if you want to put it in a positive note. He wanted to show me to not be afraid of the river. Well, I'm a great swimmer, and I'm not afraid of the water. So I thank him, what, for tormenting me in a tube? Or did I overcome it because I didn't want to be whatever? Who knows? I mean, you don't know. Is it the Abraham and Isaac story, or just a sadistic father with a helpless son? See, you can play any story any way you want. Was he toughening me up or taking advantage of a kid who couldn't fight back? You can play it any way you want. And that's the beauty of life. That's the beauty of art. That's the beauty of reality. That's the beauty of unreality. That's the beauty of no psychotherapy. That's the beauty of talk radio. That's the beauty of beauty. That's the beauty of the ribba. That's the beauty of the tube. That's the beauty of the falls. And that's all I have to say about that. So I've given you a little warm-up for what's coming in my future book, Train Tracks, and what's coming in my live performances. Because once I get started talking, I get spontaneous. And that I have to be careful of, because you don't know how far to go and how far not to go and what you want to say and what you don't want to live with, what you do want to live with. I thought about this carefully for the last few weeks, so I'm not ashamed of what I just told you. Because I had nothing to do with it, number one, and I've overcome it, number two. And number three, I think it's a very important story apropos of what we have been talking about. I believe children who are psychologically abused or physically abused usually turn out to be great parents because they make their mind up never, ever, ever to do to their children what was done to them. And, you know, I could go on and on about it. I mean, children of hookers, you ask them. There's no shame in being the child of a prostitute. You had nothing to do in choosing your mother. They sometimes make the best parents. Think about that one.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
give the policies of the last decade another try, then you should vote for Mr. Romney. Like I said, I know I've got supporters here. You should vote for his allies in Congress. You should take them at their word, and they will take America down this path. And Mr. Romney is qualified to deliver on that plan. Oh, he is.
You may have heard that President Obama is on the other side of the state, and he's going to be delivering a speech on the economy. He's doing that because he hasn't delivered a recovery for the economy. And he's going to be a person of eloquence as he describes his plans for making the economy better. And if you want to see the results of his economic policies, look around Ohio, look around the country, and you'll see that a lot of people are hurting. A lot of people have had some real tough times. And the policies the president put in place did not make America create more jobs. As a matter of fact, he made it harder for America to create more jobs. Now, when he was recently elected, he went on the Today Show. And he was asked about what he'd do, how he'd measure his success. He said, look, if I can't turn the economy around in 3 years, I'll be looking at a one-term proposition. And he's right. He is looking at a one-term proposition.
You have to listen to some of this audio, including socialist Bernie Sanders saying, we need more red tape, more regulation.
It is once again almost beyond belief. We are where we are today because Wall Street fought for deregulation, fought for the end of Glass-Steagall, fought to allow commercial banks to merge with investment banks, to merge with insurance company, fought to allow them to be able to sell worthless products without the kind of proper regulation to know what's going on. The end result is they drive us into a recession, and then Mr. Romney says the solution is to deregulate them even more. Let them do even more of the mischief that they do. The bottom line here is that what we need is a Wall Street and financial institutions that cease being the largest gambling casino in the world and start investing in the productive economy in America and start helping us to create the jobs we desperately need.
Now listen to the Congressional Black Caucus Chairman Emanuel Cleaver talk about the national security leak story.
When you start trying to hold people in contempt because they've chosen to enforce the laws that they swore to enforce, Lyndon Johnson in 1968 signed into law a measure that would prohibit the Justice Department from ever presenting or leaking or giving away information secured in a wiretap. And what Eric Holder is being threatened about is obeying that law. And it's happening in Washington so much, and it's a sick moment for our nation. It's a dark moment because what we're doing is we are so caught up into the disposal of President Barack Obama that we are dropping down into a level of incivility and something that most people have never seen before, that it's making this entire political process soil to the point that nothing is productively happening.
Finally, you must hear Leon Panetta tell Lindsey Graham that there is a high risk of a cyber attack against the United States in the next 5 years. Well, that's very confidence instilling, I must say.
You said something that just kind of went over everybody's head, I think, that there's a Pearl Harbor in the making here. You're talking about shutting down financial systems, releasing chemicals from chemical plants, releasing water from dams, shutting down power systems that could affect the very survival of the nation. What's the likelihood in the next 5 years that one of these major events will occur?
Well, with, you know, all I can tell you
is that a high probability or a low probability?
All I can tell you is that technologically the capability to paralyze this country is there now.
Is there a growing will to use that capability by our enemies?
I think the more this technology develops, the more the will to potentially use it is going to take place.
Would you say there is a high probability that the capability and the will?
I think there's a high risk.
Here's what's in the news today on michaelsavage.com. Obama's visiting New York and they're shutting down the trains. Military has taken control in Egypt. I guess it's not really the Arab Spring. What would you call it, Mr. Carter, Mr. Obama? The same day that Egypt dissolves the parliament, you're still calling it an Arab Spring? I'd call it an Arab dictatorship. Obama forgets to pay Father's Day lunch tab. Pentagon to salute gay troops. Cameron grilled on ties to tabloid editors. Chavez building drones with Iran help. Man owes child support to 15 women, has 20-plus kids. Spielberg is behind Obama's Bain Capital attack. Pizza vending machines coming to New York. We'll see what Napoleon Bloomberg does with them. HBO apologizes for putting George W. Bush's head on a stake. Witness details shower encounter in Sandusky sex abuse trial. New York Mets exploring quiet section at stadium for autistic fans. Parking lot fight between men ages 81 and 70 leaves one dead. Oregon, man stricken with the plague. Suicides, number two cause of death in the military. Iran arrests killers of nuclear scientists. What else is in the news? Putin says Russia is ready to respond to the U.S. missile defense. What else is in the news? Well, all this and more on michaelsavage.com.
Wait, hang on before I go. I read an article on how the economy has affected consumers and that customer service and return policies are really now the main reasons people choose to do business with a company. Case in point, it's time to replace the blinds, shades, or shutters in your home. You take your measurements, you head off to the big home improvement store. Sure, they take your order. But when your window coverings arrive, you find out they don't fit because the schmuck from the plumbing department gave you bad advice. You trudge back and they tell you, sorry, no returns on custom orders. Not at blinds.com. Not at blinds.com. See, even if you mismeasure, which almost never happens, they'll remake it for free. Who does that? There are also over 100 real experts in-house happy to assist. Get free color samples, free shipping, and no sales tax in most states. Plus, expert installers if you need one. That's blinds.com, where their prices absolutely crush home improvement store prices. Blinds.com. I've used them for blinds. I love them. Blinds.com. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Welcome to the new Soviet States of America. This is the Savage Nation. If you just joined us, we've been talking about something that is very, very apolitical, which is that I spent all morning going through photos of my life for a book I'm going to be putting out. Harper's is putting it out called Train Tracks. And I've asked the audience to call in with what pictures from my very versatile background would they like to see in the book, and that's what we've been doing. And we'll continue to do so in a moment because some of the callers are amazing. But I want to read a news story that just came out because I cannot believe this. I want you to see how the communists control Hollywood and the schools to an extent that you would never believe could be allowed in the United States of America. Here's the headline. School bans Schindler's List producer for being too conservative. A Marine veteran and Academy Award-winning film producer said he was barred from speaking to a U.S. government class at a Montana high school because he was called a right-wing conservative. Gerald Molan, who won an Oscar for co-producing Schindler's List, had been invited to speak to a class of seniors at Ronan High School in Montana. Molan, who was a popular motivational speaker, said his speech was going to be apolitical. He had planned on reminding students of their individual greatness and opportunities for the future. But when he showed up at the high school, about 90 minutes from his home in Big Fork, Montana, the principal informed Molan that he would not be allowed to address students because he was, quote, a right-wing conservative. He was told that there had been some calls to the school complaining about the planned speech. He said some callers didn't want kids exposed to that, despite not knowing what my message would be. Molan, who also worked on films like Jurassic Park and Twister, wrote a letter to the local newspaper explaining what happened and expressing his outrage. He said, I served 3 years in the Marine Corps so that others might stand before their peers or even a group of students, and never did I think my voice would be stilled by some mysterious callers on the notion that I might say something that they thought would not be in the students' best interest, he wrote. So this is what's going on now in the United States of America, which is that communists in our schools are hiring only left-wing hacks to give addresses to graduates. You never, ever see a conservative speaking to the children at a graduation ceremony across this great land. The left-wing rats have taken over the entire cultural apparatus, starting with Spielberg, Katzenberg, and Ratzenberg, and running right down to your local high school. Conservatives need not apply. Isn't it odd that I, Michael Savage, with a PhD from the University of California at Berkeley, 1978, and two prior master's degrees, and the author of 26 or 28 books, and the broadcaster of a daily radio show, has never been invited to give a speech to a university, to a graduating class? Instead, they hire every left-wing failure they can get their hands on, as long as they hate America, mommy, daddy, the flag, and the country sufficient to get through the door. That's the country you're living in. The fact of the matter is, this Marine veteran, this award-winning producer, is owed an apology. Is this what you want in the United States of America? Is this what you want in America, that your children be indoctrinated by these far-left communists who have controlled who do control every aspect of their life? How do you feel about liberal censorship? How do you feel about the fact that even in Montana, the liberals have invaded from California and Oregon and have stolen the schools? I can give you the email address of the school board for the Ronan School District if you want. It's okay to expose them to communism and internationalism, but not to American values. So let's go back to the callers. Jenny, welcome back to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. I humbly give you my opinion as quick as I can. I feel that, as I told you, our journey is spiritually going circular up. I feel like that when you had actual experiences in that neighborhood as you were a child, you weren't wise enough, you weren't self-actualized enough.
But wait, hold. First of all, I didn't grow up in that neighborhood. I never met my grandfather. You don't know that, Jenny. He died before I was born. I never met him.
Okay. Well, then I'll revise. Oral traditions or whatever of your grandfather that were shared with you at a time in your life when you weren't open enough wisely or self-actualized enough.
All right. I heard one thing passed down to me about what my grandfather said. You want to hear it?
Sure.
Here's all I ever heard he said. My grandfather said that a man does not need a building in order to meet God. He doesn't need a synagogue. He doesn't need a church. He said a man with a back to a tree can meet God. A man can talk to God with his back to a tree.
And that's a wise statement. And I think that plays right into what I'm feeling about this for you, that you are now still circling on your spiritual journey. And you have been blessed to read this date and revisit this thinking. Your grandfather is still with you. He's speaking to you. He's obviously wanting you to think of what you just told me. What a wonderful thing. He wants you to reflect on that and embrace that. And he's trying to raise you, in my opinion, to even a higher self-actualization in your spiritual journey. So I feel like...
So in other words, my stumbling upon this fact and my speaking with my audience on the Savage Nation is an attempt for me to speak more profoundly and more regularly with God.
Not to impose my thinking on you, but that's what I would say.
All right. Well, Jenny, thank you, and God bless you. We'll send you a copy of Train Tracks. You know what? Send Jenny Trickle Down Tyranny, because I have them right now. I can't promise a book out right now, you know. That's amazing. Spirituality, this is amazing. This is amazing. If you'd rather we do politics, we can do that. At all uneasy with this topic. I don't know that you would be. I don't really know what the audience wants to do right now. So while you're thinking about what you want me to do, politics or pictures that you'd like, this pictures from my life that you'd like to see in the book Train Tracks, let's hear a rock and roll favorite of mine, Come Go With Me by the Del Vikings, right here on the Savage Nation. Come on, downbeat one. Good. So in other words, a guy could go into a school and teach your son to lay down with a boy, your daughter to lay down with a girl, and the principal smiles and says that's the kind of values we want in America today. But if someone goes in and talks about God and country, they're considered an enemy of the state. How do you like that? How do you like America under Obama? That's all. Unbelievable. That's the story. That's the world I live in. That's the world. That's why I say you have no idea what a blessing it is for you to be listening to me on the radio. And I say a blessing not because I'm an egotist. Yes, I have an ego sufficient to do the show, but most of the days I walk around with a very humble view of myself in the world. I understand that. Do you have any idea what a miracle it is that you are still allowed to listen to an independent mind on AM radio on 310 stations across America? You have any idea that this was not always so and that in most parts of the world it is still not so? Do you know that in England there is no such thing as freedom of speech? Do you know that in most countries of the world there's no such thing as freedom of speech? And do you know that freedom is not free? Do you know that the men who landed on Normandy were fighting precisely for this, and Obama chose not to even honor their memory? He chose instead to go to two fundraisers in San Francisco and then two more in Beverly Hills. That's the world you're living in. You're living in a totally different world than the one you think you're living in. We don't know how long we're going to have freedom of speech. We don't know how long it's going to be before the two parties ban talk radio, which they're doing already, by the way, behind the scenes. You thought it would come at you from the with a vote on the Fairness Doctrine, but you didn't know it would never come at you like that. The banning of talk radio is happening as we speak. That is why so many people are leaving the business, speakers, because they're being forced out of the industry through some let us say, hidden forces that are controlling the advertising dollars, making sure the money only flows to communists and leftists. They're sucking out all the money going to conservative shows. If you hear advertisers on my show, and I never talk about this, you want to listen to the show, you have to patronize those advertisers.
Savage.
President Obama claims that he saved the auto industry, but according to our next guest, James Shirk, was a senior policy analyst in labor economics, the real reason for the auto bailout was to save the United Auto Workers Union, not the cars. James Shirk, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Michael, it is great to talk to you today.
So give us your reason why Obama bailed out GM.
The taxpayers are going to lose about $23 billion when all is said and done on the auto bailout. But that money wasn't spent to keep factories open. It wasn't to keep suppliers operating. The entire taxpayer losses from the bailout came from subsidies to the United Auto Workers. Subsidies to this union, and only this union. Other unions, rival unions, weren't treated as well. Non-union workers weren't treated as well. But only this union saw the administration step in and intervene to ensure that their wages and their benefits didn't go through the sacrifices that are typical of the bankruptcy process.
Well, we know the national media is ignoring this huge story of over $23 billion going to the UAW because they're in the pocket of Obama. Isn't that true?
This is an enormous amount of money. And this is something that was a mistake that even the president's former car czar, Stephen Ratner, has acknowledged that, you know, they should have asked the UAW to make larger sacrifices. They didn't ask the UAW to take a pay cut. What happened instead is the administration directed tens of billions of dollars into the union's coffers. The full cost of that bailout, the $23 billion, is accounted for by the fact that the administration spent the tax dollars we all pay to protect the wages and benefits of the United Auto Workers, who are still making, after the bailout, $56 an hour in wages and benefits, twice what the average American makes.
Well, what really would have happened had President Obama not bailed out GM?
If President Obama had operated according to standard bankruptcy procedures, what that would have called for would be basically the United Auto Workers in bankruptcy to receive the same treatment as other unsecured creditors. I mean, if you go bankrupt and you owe $1,000 on five different credit cards, you can't decide to pay off your Citi card entirely and not pay off your other credit cards. Everyone is supposed to collect the same amount. What Obama did was decide that the unions with their benefit funds that provides these gold-plated retiree health care benefits for the union retirees. So the average GM unionized employee retires at the age of 56 and has almost nothing for their out-of-pocket health care expenses for the rest of their life. And it's paid for by these union trust funds that the automakers were obligated to fund. Well, the automakers went bankrupt. And Obama decided that, well, the other creditors weren't going to recover terribly much of their debts, and at Chrysler they were completely wiped out. The union was going to make a nearly full recovery on the money that the automaker owed them. There was no legal reason to do that. The bankruptcy code would have said that, look, if the other unsecured creditors weren't going to get much, the union shouldn't have got much either. But that's what Obama decided he was going to do. And so that was an extra $12 billion that went to the unions, to the United Auto Workers and not to any other union or to the non-union workers or the creditors, but only to the United Auto Workers. $12 billion at General Motors, $9 billion at Chrysler. And as a result, the union retirees are still going to collect these gold-plated benefits, much more generous than most Americans get. I mean, most everyone else has to wait till you can collect Medicare at the age of 65, and your out-of-pocket costs are still going to be about $4,000 a year or so, even once you're on Medicare. None of the rest of us get these benefits. The union gets these benefits, and they're now being paid for by tax dollars that Obama diverted to the union. If he hadn't done that, what would have happened is the union benefits would have been knocked back. They would have had to wait later to retire. They'd have to wait to their mid-60s. And once they did qualify for Medicare, the union health care plan would be just basically a modest supplement to the Medicare benefits instead of you covering almost all your expenses. So it would have been less than they expected, but they still would have gotten more generous retirement benefits than most Americans do.
How much damage, if any, would bankruptcy have done to GM? Would it have destroyed the company, or would they have reorganized anyway?
Well, General Motors did go through bankruptcy. That was actually one of the things the president got right. General Motors basically came to him the first time around and came to Bush and said, just bail us out, flat out. We want, just you give us money, let us do with whatever we want. And Obama said, no, you're not going to do that. You guys have to go through bankruptcy. You've got a lot of problems, and you need bankruptcy to get you out of a lot of these contractual obligations that are just tying you down. That was the right call. What was not the right call was deciding that, well, every other interest group was not going to get special treatment in bankruptcy. The United Auto Workers were. So normally in bankruptcy, what happens is union wages and benefits get reduced to competitive levels. General Motors had higher hourly labor costs than any of the foreign transatlantic competitors. And if you think about the airlines that have gone bankrupt, that's what happens, is the union wages get reduced down to the level of the competitors. The company can leave bankruptcy and be competitive and be in a position to stand on its own. And that's just not what happened here. Instead, the unions, they accepted huge sacrifices for new guys. For workers who weren't already members of the union, they said, okay, you get half of what we're making. But for the existing members at the union, for the existing people who were already UAW members in early 2009, they got to keep pretty much everything they had. There were a few sacrifices around the edges. They got rid of the jobs bank that paid the workers nearly full wages for not working. So there were a few things like that they sacrificed. But the pay structure, the health care benefits, the pensions, all that was kept. And there was no reason to do that. You know, normal bankruptcy law would say, you know, reduce their wages to market rates. And if they'd done that, then the taxpayers would have had to put less money into the company. And then, similarly, the taxpayers' shares in the company would have been worth more when they're sold. And we would have had fewer losses. If the administration hadn't given special treatment to the union, if they hadn't made them the most favored interest group in the bankruptcy, then the taxpayers wouldn't have lost money. They didn't need to lose money to keep the factories operating. You could have done it with just bankruptcy financing. Instead, Obama did that, plus a massive bailout to the union.
Wasn't this bailout of GM a political move by Obama to keep his base happy?
I think it's very hard to take a look at this and see that there's any economic justification for it. That they didn't need to do this. Other companies that go through bankruptcy, when airlines go through bankruptcy, you don't see the government come in and step in and say, all right, we are going to tax all Americans to pay for you pilots who have much more generous pay and benefits than everyone else to continue to have a more generous retirement and pay package. That doesn't happen in just about anywhere else. But in this case, they did, and it looks incredibly suspicious. Another example, at Delphi, it was a former subsidiary of General Motors that made parts, and it spun off, and the company was going through bankruptcy. And new General Motors had no obligation to their former subsidiary. New GM had gone through bankruptcy. All those obligations were gone. But for some reason, new GM decided to spend $1 billion to top up the pensions of UAW retirees. Now, members of rival unions like the United Steelworkers or the electrical workers, their pensions weren't topped up. The pensions of the non-union employees were not topped up. But the Obama administration oversaw GM sending $1 billion of taxpayer money to top up the pensions of the UAW retirees. And it's even more curious because the inspector general is investigating this. And former members of the president's auto task force, which oversaw the whole thing, are simply refusing to testify, refusing to cooperate, won't answer any questions about whether they and the administration directed General Motors to give special treatment to the large, influential, politically well-connected United Auto Workers, and not to give the same treatment to smaller, less influential unions or to the non-union retirees. So it's very hard to take a look at this and say it was on the up and up. I mean, if it was all on the up and up, why wouldn't you even meet with the Inspector General? Why are you refusing to answer questions? You know, this is something I think Congress should be taking a look at.
Well, I don't know what can be done to stop this from happening ever again when you have a dictator in the White House. That's why I wrote Trickle-Down Tyranny.
I think the law, the bankruptcy law, needs to be modified. We're basically, there was a loophole. Because the government was just throwing billions of dollars at the automakers, then basically the bankruptcy court said you can do what you want. As long as everyone's getting at least as much as they would have gotten if Obama wasn't throwing money in the process, then everything's fine. And I don't think that's appropriate. The standard should be changed so that, period, creditors have to get equal treatment. So that, period, you can't have the government coming in and saying we're going to give special protection to our favorite unions, but rival unions and non-union employees aren't going to get anything. So that even if the government is pouring our money, taxpayer dollars, into the bankruptcy, that you can't sort of ignore the principles of bankruptcy law to reward politically well-connected interest groups while ignoring everyone else and ignoring the legal claims of everyone else. That's not in accord with the rule of law, and the bankruptcy law ought to be fixed. To prevent that from ever happening again. But even more than that, though I think this is something that people just have to wake up to and realize. I think if more people understood that the reason that we lost $23 billion, I mean, that's more than America spends each year on foreign aid. We lost $23 billion simply to prop up the pay and the benefits of some of the most well-paid workers in America, that I think there'd be a lot more outrage and there'd be a lot more hesitancy on the part of politicians to do this again.
James Shirk, thanks for joining us today on The Savage Nation.
Michael, it's been great to talk to you, and if your listeners would like to find out more, we've got our full report online at www.heritage.org. That's www.heritage.org.
This is The Savage Nation.
Savage.
Savage Nation. What I'm actually doing here on my desk during my break is looking at tide charts, because I look on the weekend to see what the tides are going to be like. I can't go out at low tide because the channel's dredged, yes, but I don't take my big boat out unless the tide's up, because I don't want to draw mud into the sea strainers. What's interesting to me, talking about the fakeness of global warming, or which they now call climate change because they were laughed out of the theater with the global warming nonsense, now it's climate change. Of course, the children have all been brainwashed into believing it's true because of the biggest liar on the planet, Al Gore, and his fake movie. Nevertheless, I look at a tide chart. How could they draw up tide charts years in advance and be accurate if there was such a thing as global warming with ice caps melting, I ask myself. Because so far as I can tell, there's been almost no alteration, even within a centimeter, over the last 30 or 40 years in terms of tides, low tides, high tides, middle tides, your tide, my tide, ebb and flow tides, floods and ebbs and flows, and highs and lows. I actually don't like full moons. I it's a strange thing. I dread the full moon phase when it comes up every month. You know that? Isn't it funny? I don't like it. My mood changes. I feel unstable when there's a full moon. I like a crescent moon the best, frankly. I can't wait till full moons are over. I just don't like the feeling. And I also noticed something interesting. The skunks tend to come out during a full moon phase. It's when the animals are most active. Anyway, just a side thing. But you see, if you're a biological creature, as I am, and you should be, I don't know how many of you are still biological creatures, it's hard to say anymore, with the amount of Prozac-like drugs out there and illicit drugs, I don't know how many people are still biological. Many of them are now medicated to the extent that they've lost all of their natural rhythms and natural cycles. I don't know if they know anything or feel anything that's real. It's hard to say. But if you're a natural human being, you actually ebb and flow all day long with your emotions. They're not, it's not a consistency. Just as tides come and go, there's four tides a day. You have four tides a day within your own being. Because you're a natural human being. An animal feels it. You feel it. I don't mean you're supposed to be dramatic like a Heckle and a Hyde and a Jekyll and Hyde. I almost said Jekyll and Jive. During the day, as a living creature, by celestial events and by other events on the planet. You're not a machine. You're not a machine, for God's sakes. And this is my problem with the psychiatric profession and the psychomedical profession to speak of. The psychomedical profession wants you to believe that a normal state for a man is one solid emotion all day long. And if you feel anything up or anything down, there's something wrong with you and you need the psycho to give you a drug. You need therapy. You need a medication. You don't need any of that. You're supposed to feel things. You go up, then you come down, and you go up and you come down. That's a cycle in a daytime and a nighttime. And then you rest at night in order to rest your mind and your body. And even if you don't sleep, you're resting your mind. You can lay in bed with the lights off. And if you don't worry about not sleeping, if you have insomnia, I could teach you in 2 seconds never to worry about insomnia again. You'll never need another drug. Because I learned it when I was young and going through a lot of worries about business and I wasn't going to make a living and I had young kids. What am I going to do? Wah, wah, wah. I learned that man doesn't need as much sleep as he thinks he needs. That you could lay in bed with the dark room and you could say to yourself that just laying in bed in a dark room and resting your mind by resting your eyes is restful, and it is restful. And then you could say to yourself, you know what? I don't need to sleep because I'm not tired. And you can get up and do things you can't even believe that were doable at that time of night. You could look at the stars. You could learn star formations. You could write 30 emails in around 20 minutes. You could go on the internet and you can study things that you've wanted to study all your life. There's endless amount of things that you can do instead of sleeping. The worst thing you can do when you have, quote, insomnia is worry about insomnia. The next worst thing you can do if you have insomnia is take medication for insomnia because you're not really sleeping. What you're doing is drugging yourself into submission, and you're still exhausted on the inside. So if you take the natural approach to most problems, you can usually solve them. It's a little side note. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Wow, what a show we've had today out of nowhere. So many different things, pictures from my childhood, what should be in the book, the fact that there's been another fake investigation announced by the Obama administration into the national security leaks, which are a big deal, and which should be the product of an independent prosecutor along the lines of Watergate. Enough is enough with these people in the Obama administration. Who killed the 22 SEALs on that Navy helicopter? Who put them aboard one slow-flying Chinook helicopter? Why is there a big blank sound coming from the Republicans? What do they know that they're hiding? Who in the Obama Defense Department put 22 SEALs on that Chinook helicopter and killed all of them? Who wanted the SEALs to be demoralized? Who did it? Why is there no investigation? What happened to the $500 million of Solyndra money? Where did it go? Who took the money? Where did it go? Where's the $1.7 billion that disappeared under the watch of John Corzine? Who's investigating that? Who? Okay, so, you know, another investigation, you know it's going to come to nothing. I feel like I'm living in the movie Z about the corrupt Greece before it collapsed in the 1960s. If you know the Costa Gavras movie, the Costa Gavras movie Z, that's what I feel like I'm living in. A totally deceptive government with fake investigations. Go look up the movie Z by Costa Gavras. There's no difference between what was going on in Greece then and what's going on under Obama right now. It's all a charade. And by the way, all you're seeing are the shadows on the wall of the cave. You're not seeing the principal actors. You're not even seeing them perform. You're seeing the shadows on the walls of the cave. And I'm making a reference to a Greek philosopher and his view of the world from thousands of years ago. All things go around, and what goes around comes around. CJ in Texas, fire away. You're on the Savage Nation.
Hey, brother, I love you. I know you're not a Christian. I've talked to you before. You don't want to talk about Jesus, but the Holy Spirit's calling on you. And I guarantee you, buddy, you've been chosen by God. And you can say your God is the God of Israel, but that's all our God, Abraham. And I guarantee you, we're all chosen.
CJ, what do you mean calling on me? You mean like today or what?
Do what?
You're saying God is calling upon me today?
He's calling, Michael, he's been calling on you all your life. And you got to come to him, and you got to know who he is. And I'm not saying that you're going to convert to Christianity. That's your business with God. But I guarantee you, when he puts
I'm not into formal religion. I mean, you got to understand that, CJ. To me, God is God. And I don't need a messenger between me and God. That's, I got to tell you that. I mean, with all due respect to your religious beliefs, that is how I look at the world. I respect other man's religions. I don't think there's only one path to God. I have to tell you that.
Michael, I'll tell you what. All I can say
I had this discussion with the great Reverend Jerry Falwell, and a lot of listeners didn't like the conversation and where it went because Jerry Falwell said things I didn't agree with. We did not agree at all from where you're coming from, CJ. I got to tell you that. It doesn't mean I didn't respect the man. I did. But the fact of the matter is I cannot deny the religious beliefs of billions of people simply because they don't follow your way or my way. Because I don't think it's my way or the highway. I think there are many ways to approach God. And I have seen it as a spiritual wheel, and I've written about it as a spiritual wheel. And I'll tell you something else. I think that God is in the center of the hub. I think that all the spokes, meaning the principal religions on earth, are the spokes that are on the same wheel of God. And I think each one of the religions can lead us to the hub called God. The center of that wheel is God. I think a church of all faiths is what's needed right today in this world that we are living in. I think that divisiveness is killing us, killing mankind. And I think that by bringing us together, however I may have to do it, is maybe the calling that God is calling upon me.